KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I am not going to humiliate myself in front of people by picking my nose and belching. I'm a classically trained actor. I will not do this. I'll starve first. And then he called me back and said, well, they offered it to you. What should I say? And I said, okay, I'll take it.
Character actor Curtis Armstrong auditioned for the 1984 comedy Revenge of the Nerds, hoping to play the lead. The filmmakers saw him in the lesser role of Booger. Armstrong told his agent, no way. But that role became a standout in Armstrong's long career as a character actor in film and TV. In his new memoir, Revenge of the Nerd, he reflects on the original dark ending of Risky Business that audiences didn't see, and on the backstage shenanigans during the making of that movie and the hit TV series Moonlighting. But first on the news banter, the China Syndrome. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my fellow banterer, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So China. China's dealings with Hollywood have become incredibly fraught. And the poster child for this right now is Wang Junlin, the head of Wanda, who was purported to be the richest man in China, riding really high, bought Thomas Tull's Legendary in a deal that a lot of people were rolling their eyes that it seemed like a typical outsider paying dumb money for something. But everybody said, well, maybe the Chinese are smart and they're not going to make those mistakes that so many outside investors have made. But that hasn't gone particularly well. And, you know, while they still own AMC and Legendary here in this country, China seems to have cracked down very hard on Wang Junlin and created a lot of financial problems for Wanda. And this gigantic buyer that was going to take over the entertainment business from theaters to content to theme parks suddenly is kind of like a little bit drifting in the water.
Yeah, we started seeing this about 6 months ago, where the effort to buy Dick Clark Productions for $1 billion fell through, and it was a money issue. The second thing we've seen in the past few weeks has been this retreat from the theme park business. Wanda and the chairman were really, really bullish on building a rival to Disney, and it annoyed them that they would see, you know, Disney Shanghai and all of these big Disney parks around the world, and they said, we could do this, and now they're getting out of the theme park business, and it really kind of is acknowledging that Disney and the other theme park operators around the world are better at this than Wanda. But I think that the implications for the broader entertainment community are pretty big here, because Hollywood has staked so much of its future on the growth of the Chinese market. And you're seeing box offices kind of sluggish there. There's weird rules where movies get bumped and there's blackout periods and no one really knows when their movie is going to get a release date. And now you see this retreat from the biggest buyer in China. It leaves a lot of people very nervous.
Yeah, you've seen all kinds of questions about how well Jeff Robinoff's Studio 8 has done getting its money from its Chinese investors. What's going on with, you know, a whole variety of companies, including Paramount Pictures, that are, you know, looking to China for money, and giant question marks and a feeling like it's just very different there. And, you know, nobody quite knows when a deal is a deal. And this has been going on for a while. But this turn with Wanda, I think, has really made things feel much worse.
Yeah, there's so little transparency of what's actually going on. It's very difficult to report on this.
Mm-hmm, or predictability.
Yeah, exactly. So we, you know, a lot of people are trying to figure out what's actually even going on.
Yeah, so that's got Hollywood nervous at a time when I will say that, you know, some of these slate deals, we just saw Sony lose a deal with a company called L-Star, which was co-financing a lot of its movies and lost a lot of money on a lot of Sony loser movies. And that broke up. You know, Brett Ratner had his partner, James Packer from Australia, pull out of that deal. I mean, it just feels like these slate finance deals are shaky, too. In Hollywood, is, you know, it's unless you're Disney, which finances all of its own movies, it's an interesting time.
I absolutely agree.
So now we turn to Sinclair, which has a pending deal to expand dramatically how many television stations it owns. This is a very conservative and penny-pinching company. You'd say it's a news company, but you'd have to put that somewhat in quotes. Bloomberg has a big piece about the slant and the penny-pinching and the product placement where some of the reporters had to wear certain jackets on the air advertising clothing companies. It's just like stuff that would not be considered normal in the news business. And it seems that Rupert Murdoch is a little nervous about this deal.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big conservative-leaning TV station group, essentially, and they are potentially going to take over the Tribune stations. And Tribune is, you know, another big station owner, and would give them access to a bunch of TV stations in the major markets. And the end game here, many believe, is to create a competitor to Fox News. And as we know, Fox News has thrived over the past 20 years by being the outlet on television for conservative-leaning news, and that has been essentially a monopoly. And I think the Murdochs must be very concerned about a potential competitor for Fox News at a time when Fox News recently lost its longtime leader, Roger Ailes, in the sexual harassment scandals, and its most popular host in Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah, so while Sean Hannity is still carrying the torch for Donald Trump, people noted certain Murdoch publications and properties taking a shot at Trump, the most striking being the New York Post July 11th editorial headlined, "Donald Trump Jr. is an idiot." But there were other things, including a Wall Street Journal editorial saying that Trump and his family seemed oblivious to the realities, the brutal realities of Washington politics. So, you know, you see that the one interpretation, a source told one of our colleagues that, you know, Murdoch is kind of leaning on Trump a little bit, saying, what is this thing with Sinclair? I have been loyal to you. Why are you not being loyal to me?
Yeah. And, you know, Rupert Murdoch has had a very mixed and up and down relationship with Donald Trump. He was a very outspoken tweeter against Trump and, you know, said, don't do this. Don't run for president. You're embarrassing yourself. Of course, when Trump later won,
he changed
his tune and is now a frequent caller to the White House. But yeah, Donald Trump presents a very big conundrum for the Fox News apparatus because they have benefited greatly by his election. And, you know, Fox and Friends is now arguably the most influential morning show in television because Donald Trump watches it and loves it. But, you know, there's other more business-oriented things that are at play that the Murdochs really care about.
I'll just quickly say, meanwhile, that the upfronts, you know, it has been reported now, everybody was wringing their hands that this was going to be, especially for broadcast, a disaster this year in terms of ad sales. We are now hearing that across the board, there are increases in ad sales, despite the fact that ratings are down. So, you know, there is hope.
This just comes down to the wild west of digital advertising and the fact that you really don't know what you're buying and you could be buying against some anti-Semitic YouTube video. But with TV, it's a safer bet. So people are gravitating towards that.
Yeah, still a big tent and still a safer bet. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. You may not immediately recognize the name Curtis Armstrong, but if you've seen Risky Business or Revenge of the Nerds, you're familiar with his work.
And from the Lambda Mu team, Dudley Dawson.
Booger.
Booger.
In his new memoir, Revenge of the Nerd, Armstrong shares stories from his exceptionally successful career as a character actor. This was not the life that Armstrong had planned as a young man when he devoted himself to becoming a classically trained theater actor. When he auditioned for the 1983 movie Risky Business, Armstrong expected that this was just a brief break from his true calling. He played Miles, best friend of uptight high schooler Joel, played by the then 19-year-old Tom Cruise. With Joel's parents out of town, Miles encourages his friend to embrace a certain life philosophy.
Joel, you want to know something?
What?
Every now and then, say what the f***. What the f*** gives you freedom? Freedom brings opportunity. Opportunity makes your future.
Armstrong's long list of credits include the 1980s ABC series Moonlighting with Cybill Shepherd and Bruce Willis, and more recently, Fox's New Girl and the CW's Supernatural. I'm curious about this idea of being a character actor, which is a career, but I was reading something recently because there was all this SAG-AFTRA negotiation,
right.
And somebody had written, like, it used to be possible to make a living as an actor, not a movie star, and now not so much. Now, is that something you think is true?
I think that that's true. However, you've just reminded me of a story I haven't thought of in years. It was when I was starting in New York. I used to go every day, as actors tended to do who were not working. I used to go to the Equity Lounge, the Union Lounge, and there was a group of older actors. They're all sitting around telling stories about,
right.
You know, opening in The Black Crook in 1918 or something. And and I would hear them every once in a while. It was very discouraging because they would be saying, I don't know how they do it, these kids, I don't know how they do it. How do they make a living at this? When I was here in New York in 1942, you could make a living. You could live in a place. These kids, I don't know how they're going to survive. I don't know.
That's scary.
And I would always hear it. It was this constant thing. Years later, when I was sort of going back and forth between L.A. and New York, and I was sitting at a bar with some friends, theater friends, and we're sitting around, and I was saying, you know, the thing that I don't understand is how they do it now. I mean, how do you get here? How do you make a living? You know, when I came here in 1976, and it suddenly occurred to me, I was channeling this old guy who was probably dead by that time, and I had turned into that.
You were that guy.
I was that guy who was now saying, how do the kids do it? And I don't know the answer. I really can't imagine how they do it.
Is it a perennial question or is it more real now?
I think
now?
It's generational. I think you get to a point and everything is changing all the time. What's fueled it now is the technology has changed, and that's the biggest issue, I think, for actors. The one good thing about it is that young actors coming into the business don't know that it was any better. So for them, when the time comes, they're going to be sitting around the table saying, I don't know how they're making it now.
So your plan was to be like master thespian.
Yes, that was the plan. I was going to be a stage actor. I trained for that. There was a school near Detroit, the Academy of Dramatic Art, which was staffed entirely by British acting teachers. So I attended that for 2 years and then went out to make my way in the world as a stage actor, which was my intention. I came out of it a complete fascist. As far as that goes, you were a stage actor, a live stage. You did not do movies. Television, you didn't even think about doing television. It was that kind of snobby stuff. And I was doing fine. I was doing national tours. I was doing regional theater and dinner theater and off Broadway and the works.
Obviously, from the book, I know that you got an agent, and the agent brings you this audition for Risky Business.
Right.
And you are thinking,
it goes against every instinct I have. Every misguided instinct I had was doing the audition for Risky Business. On the other hand, even I, who had no experience with film, knew a great script when I read one, and it was a great script. So I was tempted for that reason, but at the same time, I was scheduled to do a summer of rep at New Jersey Shakespeare.
Which was very
desirable.
Which was
desirable, a regular job. Yeah. And it was a desirable job for actors in New York in those days. And so I was really torn. But I went in anyway and read for it again. It was one of those that went on and on forever. And then they gave it to me, to my unutterable astonishment. But I still approached Risky Business as a one-time event. It was only going to be this once, and that was it.
And then, of course, you have this very fun stuff about the young Tom Cruise.
Young Tom Cruise, yes. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, of course, I didn't know who he was, but it was actually, I talk about it in the book, because there was a diary I was keeping at the time, so there's a lot of material.
You looked really young, I guess, because
I looked
you were
really
significantly
young.
Older than
yeah,
the
I
other.
Yeah, I was 9 years older than Tom, and we were both playing high school students, which, I mean, you know, for the first, it really wasn't until Moonlighting in 87, I think, that I started playing a character who would have been believably close to my age. Because up till then, I was always playing high school students, and I was 30, 31 years old.
You know, I've written so much about Tom Cruise and his relationship with the Church of Scientology, but in your day, He was walking around as a young Bible-thumping womanizer.
Well, no. Like, I mean, I'll tell you the truth about that is that, I mean, that was what he would always say. I would say to him, you want to go to the bar after work? And he'd say, oh, no, I gotta go home and work on my lines, work out, read some Bible. And I went, wow, read some Bible? Really? But in retrospect, I think that that was all part of his method. It was part of his process. Because he also used to never call us by our real names. Yeah. He would always call us by character names.
Right.
And I think he would just do that to stay in the head.
Did he really read the Bible?
As far as I know. I mean, he said he was.
You did
in
see
a hotel,
some other,
they usually
a lot
have
of
one.
Young
you know?
Women hanging around.
I could see. Yeah, well, that's true. Well, see, that's what happened later on.
Ah.
Initially, he would not come to the bar. He would, you know, it was very serious. His room was spotless. I'll tell you that. I would go to his hotel room and it was uncanny. I mean, there was not a speck of anything, no papers, no nothing. It was just perfect. And I always thought maybe that was part of his thing because Joel would have been like that.
Method.
Joel would have had a neat room. He would have been religious. He would have, you know, not drink, all that kind of thing. I figure. You know, so then, of course, it winds up being after he got comfortable within that role, then, you know, we started to see a little more of the actual Tom, and he let his hair down, and the next thing we know, we're, you know.
I'm wondering whether it was the actual Tom or whether he was playing a character that gradually goes that way.
Who knows? But, you know, the truth is, I mean, you know, once you start getting into that area, you know, then that's a rabbit hole I don't want to go down. But it was just, he was really a normal 19-year-old guy who had, you know, grabbed the brass ring. He was very committed, very professional, great work ethic. There was no messing around during the shooting. You know, very ambitious, clear idea of what he wanted. Those were character traits that were unknown to me or anyone I knew. You know, we just did our job and auditioned to the best of our ability and got on with it. But I always had the sense that he had a goal in mind.
On Risky Business, the David Geffen of it all is sort of interesting. I mean, he made it happen. David is obviously,
absolutely.
There's no force like David Geffen. He willed that into existence.
He did. I mean, it had been turned down by everybody. Paul Brickman had a deal, production deal, with John Avnet, and they were trying to sell the movie, and no one was biting. And they couldn't figure out why. It was new stuff and not expensive. But then David Geffen got a hold of it, and Geffen actually had a deal at a studio which had already passed on the project. But because David had his deal there, and David was David, he was able to sort of force it back into the studio. So the studio was then subsequently not very happy with being saddled with something that they'd already rejected. But David was the one that kept it going and protected Paul to the degree that he could up until the kerfluffle about the ending, which was such a mess for everybody.
Well, I was going to get to that because when you read the script, the ending was different.
Yes,
and
it was very different.
Darker.
Much darker. And it went as one with Paul's concept of what the movie was about, which is greed has consequences. Risky Business was his response to the Reagan youth. You know, that was very deliberate on his part. So that was his plan. And the end of the movie, you can actually see a version of the end of the movie. It's on the Blu-ray, I think.
Is it? I thought it was the studio.
He's never been allowed a director's cut. That's never happened. But on the Blu-ray, they have...
Oh, like alternate ending.
Alternate ending in the bonus material. And so you can sort of see it, but it's very bleak and kind of devastating, really, in a good way. It's exactly where the story should go, if that's where you're starting. The argument was, people aren't going to come and see this movie six times to see that.
Mm.
They're going to want to walk out thinking that Joel and Lana are going to be happy ever after together.
Right.
And that's what they insisted.
How
that
did you
rewrite.
Feel?
Well, of course, at the time, I never saw the filmed end because we wrapped the movie and we left. They came back a year later, almost a year later, brought back Tom and Rebecca.
Which is crazy.
Yeah. To reshoot the ending because...
Of course, you know you can be sure that Tom looks exactly the same because he does now.
Except he didn't.
He actually was a sort of a chubby-faced kid.
He was a chubby-faced kid, but in the last scene, that's how you can tell,
oh.
He's even heavier because he had just been doing All the Right Moves, where he was playing a football player, and he'd gained weight for the for that role.
And there was no CG.
So when he comes back, when he comes back at the end of the movie, as it, as we know it, with the two of them walking along, saying, "Where do you think we're going to be 10 years from now?" and all that, that was all stuff that was added to make it a happy ending. But you can see he's noticeably heavier at the end of the movie. But then a few years ago, Paul, for an anniversary, did a cut of the movie with the original ending in it. And he invited me up to Santa Barbara because he was showing it at the University of Santa Barbara. And so I'm sitting there next to Paul and John, and the movie's going, and I'm just loving it, and it's all so familiar. And then it suddenly gets into this place, and, you know, after a while, you know every moment, right? And I'm going, what the heck? I don't remember that. And suddenly you're into the last scene. And it took my breath away. It was obvious that it had been stuck on because it was never color corrected or anything like that. So it obviously looked weird compared to the rest of the print. But just a killer ending, and he never told me he had put it on. So I experienced it for the first time as part of the movie, and it was dramatic.
You were like, oh my God, this is a bummer.
Yeah.
I'm depressed.
Thanks
now.
For bringing
Thank you,
me down, man.
But it was David again, very insistent on having the upbeat ending.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And he was commercially speaking, right. Do you have a judgment?
That's
was
not,
it right, or was it wrong? It kind of broke Paul Brickman's heart.
Well, I don't think he ever watched it again until that screening.
His way.
But yeah, I mean, I feel like, yes, I understand exactly the financial reasons for it, and I understand commercially that was what they needed to do. Absolutely. Do I think the original version was the right version? Absolutely.
Coming up after a short break, actor Curtis Armstrong tells us about refusing to play Booger and then relenting, and about tense times with the two feuding stars on the set of Moonlighting. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to character actor Curtis Armstrong. His new memoir is called Revenge of the Nerd. In the raunchy 1984 comedy of almost the same name, Armstrong played the super slob nerd Booger. Anthony Edwards played Gilbert, one of the leading nerd characters, who tells Booger about his girlfriend, Judy.
She's a nice girl.
Big deal. Did you get in her pants?
She's not that kind of a girl, Booger.
Why? Does she have a penis?
It's not surprising that as an actor, the role of Booger was not exactly Armstrong's first choice.
I had auditioned for it in the role that Anthony Edwards played,
the lead
with Bobby Carradine. And then they said, no, we don't really want you for that. What we really want you for is Booger. And I remember telling my agent, if they want me to play that part, you tell them, no, thank you. I am not going to humiliate myself in front of people by picking my nose and belching. I'm a classically trained actor. I will not do this. I'll starve first. And then he called me back and said, well, they offered it to you. What should I say? And I said, okay, I'll take it. Because, of course, all I needed to do was hear myself sound like I stood for something. And then it blew over and I took the job.
And that was kind of defining. Although, as you point out in the book, a lot of the Why don't you read this paragraph?
Like many comedies of the period, the misogyny, both on screen and behind the scenes, was off the charts. In the case of Nerds, it seems a little more extreme because the rest of the film makes such a point of its progressive message. Its treatment of blacks, women, and gays certainly doesn't stand up to scrutiny by today's standards, assuming today's standards are that much of an improvement over those of 1984.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a subject we're much in the conversation right now. Right?
Absolutely, it is.
But there are things in that movie that would not fly.
Oh, no, absolutely. No, it was very much, you know, of its time, at least.
But its heart was very much in the right place.
Its heart was on its sleeve because, and it's hard to imagine this now, but the truth is they wanted to have a movie that would be a parable of anti-Semitism, basically. That was where Steve Zacharias and Jeff Buhai, who were the screenwriters, Jeff Canoe, who was the director, this was always an underlying subtext in that movie. It's hard to think about it because of the panty raids and everything else, but that was the idea. And however, you know, they treated the character of Lamar, the gay black nerd, obviously very much an 80s stereotype, the truth was, for them, that was an important move in the first place, just having him be a part of it. And they, I think, had had that idea from the beginning that this was going to be a parable. This was, we were going to make connections. So we have the burning nerd sign on the lawn. We have the violence, the horrible violence of the Alpha Betas trashing their house, throwing rocks through the window, all that kind of thing. The abuse and the physical assaults that take place in a comedy were pretty remarkable for a movie like that, that was being sold as nothing more than a gross-out sex comedy. And it was a gross-out sex comedy, but it was also making a point about inclusion and tolerance and anti-bullying, which was very deliberate.
Well, so let me jump to Moonlighting. I mean, in Moonlighting, it's just, you know, it's kind of funny. Sybil Shepherd's reputation certainly precedes her. She's not an easy person. And you don't, you know, you make it very clear that she and Bruce Willis were not a fun couple, and they had that competitive thing where they, like, literally measured how close their trailers were to the set.
Well, you know, this is the thing, is that obviously anyone who was around at the time knew. It was pretty widely reported. These are things that are in the book, but they weren't, like, revelations that no one ever heard before. Everybody kind of knew that Bruce and Sybil didn't get along. And it was unfortunate, and it was hard on other people. It was hard on us, Elise Beasley and me. It was especially hard on guest stars who were working with two people who didn't really give them much. That was difficult. But something else happens, which is weird, that you have that spark between two people like Bruce and Sybil. If they had been in love or even friendly, that spark would almost certainly not have been there. What everyone took as sexual chemistry may have been nothing more than just irritation at having to do one more take with this person. I mean, that those two people were just, for that period, an amazing phenomenon.
It was. So just getting to the whole thing of the book, there's a sort of a theme about coming to appreciate what the industry and the career that you've had is without, you know, I think there's a story you tell about talking to one of your teachers and saying, you know.
Oh, when I went back to apologize?
Yes,
for my career?
That story.
Yeah, I know. This was one of my English acting teachers, a Canadian, actually, this guy. But he was one of the old school teachers that I'd learned from. And we had a reunion, and I went back, and I just started babbling to this guy about how sorry I was that I hadn't stuck to my original intention of being a classical stage actor, and, you know, here I am doing these horror, and I'm just basically trashing all of my work, and he's just letting me go. He's just letting me wind down, at which point he said, "Curtis, you trained to be an actor. That's what we were doing." He said, "You're an actor. Congratulations." And it was one of those little clicks that you get in your head of realizing that you need to sort of get some perspective.
And did you? Do you?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
There's no voice in your head anymore saying you should have done.
No, absolutely not. I'm so at ease with it. I would say, maybe not literally, but virtually not a single job I've had in 40 years that I can look back on and say, oh, God, never should have done that.
Wow.
I don't think there's one. I mean, most of them, if they were really bad or really unpleasant, at least they're not things I'm faced with all the time. I just look back on a life of work, and some of it was great and some of it was terrible. And that's what makes a career.
And success.
Yeah.
Actor Curtis Armstrong's memoir, Revenge of the Nerd, is available now. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay, nerd.
And that's the business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.